Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. On this edition, we have a report from Liam Moriarty in Ashland, Oregon. One of Oregon's hot tourist spots in the summer, Ashland city officials have received many complaints last summer from merchants and residents about aggressive panhandling. They're looking at the issue now in preparation for the tourist season. In the second half of the show, investigative reporters John Ryan and Carolyn Arnold take a hard look at Washington's fragile transportation infrastructure. But first, Salem correspondent Chris Lehman tells us that now that recreational marijuana is legal and respectable in Oregon, activists and entrepreneurs are taking next steps and running for public office themselves.
5 years ago, Bree Malarkey and her family decided they were tired of the hectic pace of life in the Willamette Valley. They bought 40 acres outside the southern Oregon town of Shady Cove. They have a few goats and an enormous herb garden.
This is motherwort. It's getting ready for its very first harvest. Echinacea over here is just starting to pop.
And that's not all.
We have lemon balm, chamomile, catnip, and cannabis all growing side by side.
That's right. One of her crops is cannabis, as in marijuana. And not only does she grow the stuff, she sells it. Malarkey runs two Southern Oregon dispensaries that sell to both recreational and medical customers. As a marijuana business owner, she closely followed the legislature's actions on marijuana over the past 2 years. And she says she came to this conclusion.
The overburdensome regulations that many legislators were putting into place and administrative rules as the agencies implemented the programs were not going to be advantageous to starting a successful small business enterprise here in Oregon.
And so she decided to throw her hat in the ring. She's running for a seat in the Oregon House. It's her first run for public office. She's one of three legislative candidates in Oregon this year with close ties to marijuana, either as business people or as activists. Others are running for local offices.
These are really symbolic gestures.
Amy Margolis isn't sure any of the candidates will win. Margolis heads a marijuana industry group called the Oregon Cannabis Association. She says she looks forward to a time when office holders have a level of expertise in the subject and don't have to be schooled in Pot 101. But she says even if they don't win, just running is a logical next step.
I think you're going to see different levels of seriousness and different levels of sophistication with that engagement. But that's what it demonstrates to me, is that the activists are maturing in their approach.
And Margola says not all of the candidates even want the same thing. While Bree Malarkey is concerned about regulations on her business, Tyler Gabriel says he's running for the Oregon House because he's worried about possible threats to the state's medical marijuana program.
The state of Oregon seems to think that they can eliminate the medical marijuana program and eliminate medicine from their patients and have it all taxed like as if they're recreational users. That's their goal, and that's what's slowly happening. And I want to prevent that.
Gabriel is running in a House district in North Central Oregon. He's a medical marijuana patient who also grows for other patients. A third legislative candidate is Stormy Ray, a longtime medical marijuana activist who's running for a state Senate seat in Eastern Oregon. Regardless of whether they win or not, the political climate around marijuana is a far cry from 1992. That's when Bill Clinton famously said on TV,
I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
I didn't inhale became a national punchline, but Clinton, of course, went on to become president. Bree Malarkey says, as a young adult, she actually got to meet Clinton during that campaign. And ironically, despite growing and selling marijuana, she's used it even less than the former president.
I personally don't use cannabis. I don't have a medical need, but I believe in freedom of choice, and I believe in people being able to have safe access to make their own decisions for their own body. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Come November, Malarkey's party affiliation could be a bigger political liability than her cannabis career. She's seeking to oust the top Republican in the Oregon House in a district where GOP voters far outnumber Democrats. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
Our next two stories take a look at potential changes to the way residents and tourists may be recreating in the Northwest this season. There is an effort to amend the Wilderness Act to allow one form of mechanized transportation into pristine areas, and conservation groups are lining up against the idea.
When the Wilderness Act was passed in the 1960s, one main concept was to keep mechanization out of areas declared as wilderness. Years later, Congress specified that that would include one human-powered device, the mountain bike. Now those enthusiasts are asking lawmakers to sponsor legislation that would allow bikes in. Ted Stroll, president of the Sustainable Trails Coalition, says the machines have a very minimal impact.
Riding a mountain bike is quiet, slow-moving, and environmentally benign. It is ironically much more environmentally benign than uses that are currently permitted in wilderness, such as commercial profit-making horse and pack stock trains that go into wilderness areas all over the western United States and do a tremendous amount of damage to meadows, trails, and streams and lakes.
One who feels the bikes are not appropriate is Mike Peterson of the Lands Council of Spokane, one of 116 groups that sent a recent letter to Congress opposing efforts to allow the bikes into wilderness.
It impacts wildlife when someone's rushing through the woods on a mountain bike. They're going, you know, five or more times faster than you could walk, and so that's a very big difference on wildlife. They cross through creeks, they cause erosion if they're on steep trails, they displace rocks, they tend to run over plants that are near the trails. Trails get widened because they, you know, form dips and there's mud puddles, and so then you have wider and wider trails.
There may be room for compromise with some conservation groups, however. Susan Drumheller of the Idaho Conservation League, which did not sign on to the letter for Congress, issued a statement hinting compromise is possible. It says, quote, "Our approach is to work out boundary issues before wilderness legislation is enacted. We're also interested in alternative designations where mountain biking could be allowed while preserving conservation values," unquote. The mountain bike proponent says it's hoped some members of Congress will craft legislation this spring to modify the Wilderness Act. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
The downtown economy of Ashland, Oregon is heavily dependent on the tourists who flock to see the Oregon Shakespeare Festival or who come to hike, bike, ski, fish, and boat in the area's mountains and waterways. Last year, complaints from merchants, residents, and visitors about aggressive panhandling and uncivil behavior by some of the homeless people reached a fever pitch. Jefferson's Public Radio's Liam Moriarty reports that now city officials are looking for fresh ideas to head off a new season of unpleasantness.
Recent summers have seen a growing influx of young transients into Ashland, many of whom hang out on downtown streets. At a standing-room-only public meeting last October, one Ashland resident after another told stories of the newcomers behaving in offensive and intimidating ways. Pam Hammond Morris read a letter from her daughter, Kelly Jean.
"Some of the harassment I have been the recipient of has been mildly humorous, 'adopt me, pretty lady,' or 'gross, how often do you masturbate, can I help?' and downright threatening. Transient to me when on the phone, 'Hey, you talking to your boyfriend? I'm going to kill him up so you'll f*** me instead.'"
Many told of being met with curses and threats when they declined to give to panhandlers. Merchants testified tourists had told them they'd had ugly experiences and would avoid Ashland in the future. The city council has been discussing measures from stricter laws and tougher enforcement to enhanced services for the homeless. Some city leaders have been impressed with one program in particular.
"I'm Chris Richardson with Downtown Streets Team."
Richardson was in Ashland recently with two colleagues. Sitting outside the local homeless services center, he explained the program.
"Downtown Streets Team is what we call a work experience program. Our mission is to end homelessness through the dignity of work."
Richardson is regional director for Downtown Streets Team. The nonprofit began in 2005 in Palo Alto, California. It's since expanded into San Francisco and several other Bay Area cities. The program builds teams of homeless people who perform cleanup and beautification services around town. In exchange, they get vouchers for food and other basic needs. But Richardson says they also develop a sense of belonging and self-esteem.
"You can imagine if you've been on the street for, let's say, 5 years and a lot of opportunities haven't worked out. You lose a lot of hope, you lose a lot of dignity, and you lose a lot of motivation. So we're really good at working with those folks and building them back up."
Downtown Streets Team says it's helped hundreds of homeless people get back on their feet and into jobs and permanent housing. Pam Marsh runs the Ashland Emergency Food Bank. She's also a city council member. Talking at the food bank, she says the Downtown Streets Team approach could be a major part of Ashland's array of responses to the problems associated with homelessness.
The Downtown Streets program fits in very well to that array, and I think there's an opportunity in all of this community discussion to do something that is really a tangible way to help people change their lives.
Ashland Mayor John Stromberg agrees. He's been wrestling with what he sees as two related but distinct issues.
Dealing with disruptive behavior downtown while trying to take care of our local homeless population.
Stromberg thinks the Downtown Streets Team would help with both sides of that equation.
These people are bright, they're solid, they are community-oriented, and they're wonderful improvisers. They're perfect for us.
Not everyone is so sure. For one thing, there's the question of how to raise the Street Team program's six-figure annual cost. There were also compatibility concerns. The nonprofit Ashland Community Resource Center is the hub of homeless services in Ashland. Tina Stevens runs the center's jobs program.
I think that they have a wonderful program, and they seem like absolutely wonderful people from the bit that I've talked with them. But I don't know if their program is different enough from ours to not have us stepping on each other's toes.
A homeless Ashland resident who goes by the name Sean wonders if vouchers for food and clothing will be enough to coax many of his cohort into participating in the Streets Team program.
We have clothes. We have food. The only thing we really need is that transition to be able to have safe housing, safe and cheap housing.
There's the rub. The price of housing in the Ashland area has skyrocketed, and rents have soared as the vacancy rate has sunk below 2%. Sean also feels the local homeless people are being tarred with the same brush as the unruly transients.
We have travelers that come through that don't care about other people's backyards, and so they leave their problems behind. And the locals that are trying to make a difference are caught in the wake, and we're the ones that have to live with the new rules and the regulations.
City officials are laying plans to beef up the downtown law enforcement presence this summer. They hope that stick, plus the carrot offered by the Downtown Streets Team, assuming the council approves it, will head off another summer of conflict in paradise. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. Around April 1st is generally considered the date of peak snowpack in the Northwest, on average, and around now many irrigation districts begin filling their canals to get ready for watering season. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports the summer water outlook has grounds for optimism as well as caution.
The Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service is preparing an updated snow survey and water supply forecast. Scott Oviatt is one of the specialists working on that in Portland. He says water users have reason to be optimistic about the summer, given that the snowpack measures near normal or slightly above normal across the Northwest.
We still have the possibility of an early meltout if we would have extended periods of warm and dry conditions. So we are reminding people to be cautionary.
Oviatt says the outlook is much improved versus half a year ago when we entered winter with a strong El Nino. That climate phenomenon brought the anticipated warmer than normal temperatures, but against the odds, we managed to accumulate adequate snowpack. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
In part two of The Bridge, correspondents John Ryan and Carolyn Arnold take a look at Washington's infrastructure. It's common knowledge that you don't want to be on or under Seattle's Alaskan Way Viaduct in an earthquake. What you may not know is that bridges on I-5 and the 405 are also vulnerable to severe earthquake damage. Our reporters found out the concrete columns holding up some of the state's big bridges are hollow inside.
I'm standing by the banks of the Green River in Tukwila, right where it passes underneath Interstate 405. The bottom of the bridge is just a few feet over my head. The main thing keeping that traffic off my head and out of the river is a series of 20 concrete columns. They're all hollow. With me here is WashDOT bridge engineer Dwayne Wilson. Dwayne, why are these columns a concern?
If a severe earthquake hit, there's a high risk that the inside could break loose and the column could actually implode. So it would collapse on the inside. We don't know exactly the level and the mechanism, but it is a high concern.
Imploding concrete isn't just a concern at this bridge on the Green River. Western Washington has more than 20 bridges built like this, many of them on the busiest highways in the Seattle area. The State Transportation Department has known that the columns are vulnerable for more than a decade. Some of those bridges are being replaced along Highway 520 in Seattle and on I-5 in Tacoma, but the rest? There are no plans to do anything to keep those other bridges on 405, I-5, or elsewhere from collapsing in a big earthquake. Wilson says WSDOT is responsible for some 3,200 bridges around the state.
We're more concerned about just regular deterioration on our older bridges, and we're trying to keep the whole bridge network statewide open. So that is of higher priority right now.
Washington has more highways on hollow supports than other earthquake-prone states. To see why, you have to go back to the 1950s.
These new highways will have a far-reaching economic impact on the entire nation.
America's new interstate highway system is growing at breakneck speed. The highway lobby puts out ads and whole movies to convince the nation it's money well spent.
The nation's road builders, with specialized equipment and modern techniques, build roads of the highest quality at the lowest cost.
One modern technique of the early 60s was a stronger material called pre-stressed concrete. A company in Tacoma called Concrete Tech pioneered its use in America. The stronger concrete meant builders needed less of it to make a column strong enough to hold up a bridge. Those hollow columns were light enough to be built in Tacoma and then trucked up to construction sites around Western Washington. Local bridge builders snapped them up, and the Puget Sound region became a hotbed of hollow column bridges. As Dwayne Wilson told me, it made sense at the time. The hollow columns are almost as strong as solid ones, at least when the earth isn't moving.
What was kind of the earthquake thinking back then?
There wasn't really much, especially in the early 60s. Earthquakes just weren't a thought to most bridge engineers.
Engineering professor John Stanton met me beneath another hollow column bridge, Seattle's Portage Bay Bridge on Highway 520. We're standing in a concrete grove of columns. The busy highway is maybe 50 feet over our heads.
If a big earthquake happened right now, here we are, what would you do?
I would stop talking and run to get out from underneath the bridge very rapidly. This is not a good place to be in an earthquake.
Stanton teaches at the University of Washington. His experiments back in the 1980s showed that hollow columns could implode in a big quake.
And a couple of other people had noted the same thing before that, so it wasn't news. At the time, I was not aware that WSDOT had built a lot of bridges using these very large hollow columns.
Decision makers didn't pay much attention to WSDOT's large hollow columns until an accident one night on Lake Washington more than a decade later. In the summer of 2000, a wayward gravel barge plowed into the 520 bridge. A bridge column shattered. The accident helped spur the current megaproject to replace the half-dozen bridges on 520 and its various ramps. A year later, the Nisqually quake generated more interest in making our infrastructure safer in a big earthquake. But WSDOT engineers decided these hollow column bridges were not a priority. Here's Dwayne Wilson with WSDOT.
Nisqually, these bridges survived very well. They didn't experience any damage at all.
But the Nisqually quake was nowhere near as big as what might hit us.
If we get the big one that they're expecting, which is be the subduction zone earthquake, there's a potential for damage.
Geologists say we've got about a 1 in 6 chance of a big one from the Cascadia subduction zone hitting us in the next 50 years, or a big one could strike from the Seattle fault that runs right through the city. So far, WSDOT has spent nearly $200 million trying to harden its old bridges that don't have hollow columns. The agency has focused mostly on bridges that would be critical if the Seattle-Tacoma region needed to recover from a massive quake. WSDOT calls it the seismic lifeline. That lifeline is in long-term limbo.
Over the next 6 years, we are not funding any additional seismic retrofits.
Aside from the money problem, there is no known way to make hollow columns resist earthquakes better. WSDOT has asked John Stanton to see if there's a way out of this conundrum.
With great difficulty.
Stanton says if you tried to fill the hollow columns with concrete, they'd probably just burst from the added pressure. WSDOT has wrapped steel around some solid bridge columns, but that wouldn't stop a hollow column from crumbling apart on the inside. Stanton says if WSDOT can fund the work, he'd need about a year and a half to study whether there's a way to fix the hollow columns. Even if fixing the missing links in the region's seismic lifeline would be difficult and expensive, Stanton says doing so now makes sense.
Right now we're in a period of very low interest rates, and this would be a perfect time to invest in infrastructure because essentially you can buy it cheap. So why aren't we doing that?
Of course, state government and even WSDOT have many competing demands for the tax dollars they spend. WSDOT estimates more than $1 billion of seismic upgrades are still needed on the state's highways. That figure doesn't include any estimate for replacing or fixing the state's hollow columns. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan.
It turns out that hollow columns on the I-5 bridge and the 405, vulnerable to severe earthquake damage, are not the end of Washington's problems. Another 474 bridges and overpasses in the state need to be retrofit so they won't fail in a major earthquake event. They can be fixed. KUOW's economy reporter Carolyn Adolph tells us the Department of Transportation has no plans to fix them.
And there's been little public discussion about them. These 474 bridges take us from home to work and back. They're on I-5, I-405, and I-90. WSDOT says it can't fix these bridges now. It's putting its limited funds into bridges that could fail from lack of maintenance.
I think it's important for people to recognize that this is a threat.
This is Steve Kramer, professor of civil engineering at the University of Washington, a specialist in earthquake hazards.
Politicians have ignored the problems of the decaying infrastructure for so long that our risks with respect to earthquakes and just general wear and tear and deterioration are enormous.
The State Transportation Department says it could cost $1 billion to prepare I-5 alone for the earthquake that we're told is coming. Money it does not have. Why is that? It tends to take a crisis. Ours started in San Francisco, the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989.
Second base, so the Oakland A's take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
The next day, the state DOT here looked at the collapse of the Cypress structure in Oakland, that double-deck reinforced concrete structure. It looks almost identical to the Alaskan Way Viaduct.
Well, we're still here.
That was our first wake-up call. By 1995, Steve Kramer and the other engineers involved knew exactly how dangerous the viaduct was.
We went to the state transportation commissions. We sat in front of them and gave our testimony about the results of our analyses. There were TV cameras all over the place. It was on the news. It was a big deal for about 2 days, and then everybody forgot about it.
Until February 28, 2001. The second wake-up call.
So then 6 years later, we get the Nisqually earthquake and a few chips of concrete fall and hit some cars. And that's what it took to make the threat real.
Here we are, 2016. That's 15 years later, and we still don't have that viaduct replaced.
This is Judy Cliburn, head of the House Transportation Committee. She is one of the politicians who sets the priorities around here. Cliburn says the viaduct replacement is just one item on a giant list of work that needs to be done.
The total at the bottom was $80 billion.
$80 billion for what?
For the infrastructure needs of the state.
But Cliburn says we're in denial, even though we've had two wake-up calls.
I don't think people want to believe it. I think when you tell them how big the need is, they just look at you and they say, they just don't have the ability to have that much of a concept.
That may be why the totality of our transportation infrastructure needs does not come up for discussion when legislators commit to a budget. WSDOT only sends the short list of its needs, and the legislature chooses from that. It's different elsewhere, like in California, where earthquakes are a fact of life. Every year, California publishes a report that puts a big, scary number on the state's infrastructure needs, putting it up for public discussion, part of the annual budget process.
Our needs for deferred maintenance alone on state facilities is somewhere in the neighborhood of $77 billion.
This is H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of California's Department of Finance, at his office in the Capitol. He says publishing the entire government's infrastructure priorities
gives you a more comprehensive understanding of what the state's overall needs are.
And it gives the governor, legislators, and the public the same information, which is then used to set priorities. Without it, he says,
it would be kind of like driving without a roadmap.
Loma Prieta in 1989 was a big wake-up call for California. Afterward, the state found more than 2,000 bridges in need of retrofit. It has fixed all but two. Steve Kramer of the University of Washington.
They have made it more of a priority than we've made here.
This is I-5 over Ravenna Boulevard. Engineers say the overpasses here are clearly at risk. Steve Kramer says people who use our highways may want to know that.
I would like to know myself driving across any structure. I think it can only help bring some pressure to bear on the people who make decisions about funding earthquake retrofitting and that sort of thing.
I'm Carolyn Adolph in Seattle.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs weekly Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email us news1@kmun.org. I'm Kate Brister saying thanks for listening today, and listen again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.